As a reminder, we are jumping in the middle of a story today. And we're jumping in specifically in the middle of the story of Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus, described as the plastered cistern. The plastered cistern, as we discussed, seems to have elements of being able to recall any Torah that he has ever studied, but not necessarily generating Torah of his own. That's in contrast to a previous rabbi who we studied, who is described as an overflowing fountain. Here's where we are in the story. Let's situate ourselves. There has been a grand sort of debate between Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus and the other rabbis about the nature of a particular sort of oven. We're not going to get into the intricacies of that right now. The other rabbis seem to be consciously refusing to accept any of Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus's arguments. It says they surrounded him with words of debate like an achnai snake. It almost feels like this is an ambush that has more to do with Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus as a person than the oven itself. And Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus begins to essentially call upon these miracles to prove that he is correct. Miracles that we noted all seem to have a dangerous edge to them, including one where he actually almost brings the walls of the Beit Midrash down around them, culminating in a moment where a voice from heaven calls out, "What is it with you all and Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus? Don't you know that the halacha is like him?" When Rabbi Yoshua hears this, Rabbi Yoshua is the main antagonist to Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus in this story. He stands on his feet and calls out, "It is not in heaven." It's a moment of conscious rejection of this plastered cistern model. It is not in heaven, meaning Torah no longer resides in heaven. But on a metaphorical level, if we're going back to the idea of Torah as water, which is present in so many of these metaphors, we're not looking for the rain to fall and fill this plastered cistern. We need to generate our own water, our own Torah. The story, part one, ends on what seems like a joyful note. We noted that people often end the story there. But we're now going to begin part two of the story, in which the other rabbis decide that Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus can no longer remain in the community of the Beit Midrash. And again, as we study today, I want the question, or one of the questions that we look towards, to be, was there another way that this could have gone? Was there another way in which Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus could have remained within the community of the Beit Midrash? The sages said, on that day, the sages brought all the ritually pure items deemed pure by the ruling of Rabbi Eliezer with regard to the oven and burned them in the fire. And the sages reached a consensus in his regard and excommunicated him. Okay, let's note these two things that are happening. First of all, this is a conscious rejection of Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus's previous rulings. If he ruled that an item was pure, they're saying, we can no longer trust that. We're going to burn it because it might have become impure. But of course, we also know that anytime there's a public sort of burning of objects, it often symbolizes a sort of spiritual death of the individual as well, and a sort of potentially social death of the individual as well. And that, of course, is the next step. They excommunicated Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus. Let's pause for a moment. What does it mean for someone to be excommunicated? It means something very different in the time of the rabbis than it means today. In the time of the rabbis, it means that no one in the Beit Midrash community can speak to him anymore. No one can go within four cubits, a certain distance of him. He essentially dies a social death within the world of the Beit Midrash. They're essentially saying, we can no longer have you in our world. The sages said, who will go and inform him of his excommunication? Rabbi Akiva, his beloved disciple, said to them, I will go, lest an unseemly person go and inform him in a callous and offensive manner, and he would thereby destroy the entire world. Rabbi Akiva, it seems, is one of the only people in this story who still has deep affection, even love, for Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus. Rabbi Akiva recognizes that this is going to be terrible for Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus no matter what. And also, there is a way of doing this that will be more and less painful. And Rabbi Akiva wants to do it in a way that is less painful. Let's also note that Rabbi Akiva here is recognizing Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus's power. Lest someone go and inform him in an offensive manner and he'll thereby destroy the world. The story is forecasting. Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus has already shown himself to be a dangerous person. He can perform these miracles that involve trees uprooting themselves or the walls of the Beit Midrash falling. What is he going to do when he finds out that he has been excommunicated? What did Rabbi Akiva do? He wore black and wrapped himself in black as an expression of mourning and pain, and sat before Rabbi Eliezer at a distance of 4 cubits, which is the distance that one must maintain from an ostracized individual. Rabbi Eliezer said to him, Akiva, what is different about today from other days that you comport yourself in this manner? Rabbi Akiva said to him, My teacher, it appears to me that your colleagues are distancing themselves from you. He employed euphemism as actually they distanced Rabbi Eliezer from them. I just want to note that there's something very gentle here that even in this moment where Rabbi Akiva is informing him of the fact that he's been excommunicated, he's still calling him my teacher. That matters. That matters because as we'll see in the next story we'll study today, which is the story of Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus's death, the thing that Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus is most terrified in the world is of his Torah not being passed on, the Torah he has received from his teachers. With that one word, my teacher, Rabbi Akiva is almost promising him, yes, you've been excommunicated, but you still have some sort of root here in the Beit Midrash. I am still here and I still consider you my teacher. Your Torah is not gone. Your Torah is not forgotten. Rabbi Eliezer, too, rent his garments and removed his shoes, as is the custom of an ostracized person, and he dropped from his seat and sat upon the ground. The Gemara relates, his eyes shed tears, and as a result, the entire world was afflicted. 1/3 of its olives were afflicted, and 1/3 of its wheat, and 1/3 of its barley. And some say that even dough kneaded in a woman's hand spoiled. The entire world in this story is reacting to Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus's pain. There are different ways of interpreting this. We're going to leave aside for now the question of, is this magic? Is this miracle? Is this simply very strong metaphor? But I think at the very least, what we're supposed to recognize is that the world's response, of the crops failing, 1/3 of them, is a very real response to the pain and the destruction that's happened within the community of the Beit Midrash, right? We can't pretend that this isn't real. We can't pretend that there hasn't been real damage here. There has been, and the world is reflecting that. The sages taught, there was great anger on that day, as any place that Rabbi Eliezer fixed his gaze was burned. We're switching scenes now. We're going to look at a different character now that we haven't seen so far. This is still within the context of the story. That different character is going to be Rabban Gamliel. I want us to know a few things about Rabban Gamliel before we go on. First of all, he's the Nasi, which is the political head of the Jewish community. We'll see that he's on a boat here. Rabban Gamliel is often on a boat because he goes abroad to Rome to intercede for the Jewish people. The second thing I want us to know is that this is an inherited office. Rabban Gamliel's father before him was also the Nasi. This is a chain going back many generations. And ultimately, even though we didn't see him in the story yet, the ultimate responsibility for excommunicating Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus is his. He is the head of this community. He has the final say. And even Rabban Gamliel, the Nasi of the Sanhedrin at Yavne, the head of the sages who is responsible for the decision to ostracize Rabbi Eliezer, was coming on a boat at that time, and a large wave swelled over him and threatened to drown him. Right? The world itself, again, is reacting with Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus' feelings. And Rabban Gamliel, who's on a boat, a wave comes and almost threatens to drown him by flooding the boat. Rabban Gamliel said, "It seems to me that this is only for the sake of Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus, as God punishes those who mistreat others." Rabban Gamliel stood on his feet and said, "Master of the universe, it is revealed and known before you that neither was it for my honor that I acted, nor was it for the honor of the house of my father that I acted. Rather, it was for your honor so that disputes will not proliferate in Israel." In response, the sea calmed from its raging. We're going to come back to this next week, but this is really key, I think, to understanding what is going on in the Beit Midrash at this time. What's Rabban Gamliel's reasoning? Rabban Gamliel's reasoning is so that disputes will not proliferate in Israel. Let's talk about that for a moment. Let's remember where our starting point was here. We are coming in the wake of the destruction of the temple, and what was our very first introduction to the scene that was going on at the time when the temple was destroyed, when the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed? It was in fact that. It was in fact disputes between different factions of the Jewish people. The zealots, the rabbis, resulting in the burning of the grain, the forcing out to confront the Romans. Rabban Gamliel, it seems, may be reacting to that and saying, there are so few of us left. I understand how dangerous different factions, different disputes within the community might be. I am going to manage to keep this community together no matter what by saying we cannot tolerate disputes within it. We are going to have unity. And we now get a little bit of background into why was Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus so dangerous in the eyes of the other rabbis. Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus was never a person who was going to give up on what he thought for the sake of unity. He was never a person who was going to be quiet about what he thought the truth was for the sake of unity. That's not within his character. And Rabban Gamliel seems to have made the decision that in his view, the survival of this burgeoning new community depends on that unity. We'll come back to that next week and see how that plays out. For now, we'll continue with the story of Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus. The Gemara further relates, Ima Shalom, the wife of Rabbi Eliezer, was a sister of Rabban Gamliel. Let's just pause here for a moment. An extra layer of interconnectedness here. Rabban Gamliel doesn't just excommunicate any random rabbi. He is, in fact, Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus's brother-in-law, his wife, Ima Shalom. Note, by the way, that her name means mother of peace. Very interesting name for someone caught in the middle of this intercommunal battle. His sister is married to Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus. They're that closely related. From that incident forward, she would not allow Rabbi Eliezer to lower his head and recite the Tachanun prayer. A bit of background here. In the Talmud, lowering your head in prayer, specifically we think in by saying Tachanun, is understood to be a time when your prayers are particularly potent. It's a time when you're understood to put your head down and tears flow and all your pain comes out. And it's understood to be a moment of particular power. Ima Shalom, Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus's wife, is not allowing him to perform that sort of prayer anymore. Why? She feared that were her husband to bemoan his fate and pray at that moment, her brother would be punished. A certain day was around the day of the new moon, and she inadvertently substituted a full 30-day month for a 29-day month. She thought that it was the new moon when one does not say Tachanun, but it was not. Some say that a pauper came and stood at the door, and she took bread out to him. The result was that she left her husband momentarily unsupervised. When she returned, she found him and saw that he had lowered his head in prayer. She said to him, "Arise, you have already killed my brother." And she's looking at him. She somehow, something has gone wrong. She thought that it was Rosh Chodesh when you don't say Tachanun, but it wasn't. Or she was called to the door for a moment to give bread to a poor person and left him unattended. And he said, Tachanun, whatever it was. She gets there, she sees his head down, and she says, "It's over. I know that my brother is dead." Meanwhile, the sound of a shofar emerged from the house of Rabban Gamliel to announce that the Nasi had died. Rabbi Eliezer said to her, "From where did you know that your brother would die? Wait, how do you know this? Are you a prophet? What is going on here?" She said to him, "This is the tradition that I received from the house of the father of my father. All the gates of heaven are apt to be locked, except for the gates of prayer for victims of verbal mistreatment." What does she say to him? She says, "I have a family tradition that I inherited." Note, by the way, she seems to know of this family tradition. Does her brother not know of it? Possibly. There are certain things that God always listens to, and those include people who have been mistreated, particularly here verbally mistreated. Let's talk about this ending for a moment. There's something very interesting about it. This story is premised really on who can be allowed within the community of the Beit Midrash. Where do we get Torah from? Is it this sort of thing that comes from heaven, that comes into the plastered cistern where we have to conserve every drop? Is it this sort of thing where we have an overflowing fountain, we create our own? But there's something here that comes at the end where this woman, who never would have been allowed within the community of the Beit Midrash, turns and says, "You all are so concerned about who is allowed in and who isn't allowed in and what the nature of Torah is. But there are fundamentals that you are missing that I actually hold. And what is one piece of that? One piece of that is this tradition that I've inherited from my family about who God actually listens to." There's a key there. There's a key there that's telling us somehow there is Torah that's escaping from this Beit Midrash community. And part of what we're going to be looking for next week is, okay, and what does it look like to try to get those missing pieces of Torah back? We're going now to switch scenes for a moment. We're going to look at a different story. This is from Tractate Sanhedrin, and it's the story of the death of Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus. Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus, it seems, spends decades of his life excommunicated without any contact with his colleagues. But on his deathbed, his colleagues return to him. And there's a moment here, I think, where we begin to understand a little bit more, both about what motivated Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus. What was it about him that's willing to risk everything, including his spot in the Beit Midrash, rather than give in? And also, what was so difficult for the others about allowing him to remain within the community of the Beit Midrash? The story begins with a halacha about the laws of sorcery. Yes, there are halachot regarding sorcery. We are not going to get into that for now. Particularly in this case, the laws have to do with what if someone is gathering cucumbers by sorcery. There's a lot to say about that, which we're not going to say right now, but let's jump in. Rabbi Akiva says, in the name of Rabbi Yoshua, that two people can each gather cucumbers by sorcery, one of whom is exempt, as he merely deceives the eyes, and one of whom is liable, as he performs real sorcery. And did Rabbi Akiva learn this from Rabbi Yoshua? Meaning, we start with a statement that Rabbi Akiva learned about the laws of sorcery from Rabbi Yoshua. And we bring an objection, as the Talmud often does. Wait, did he really learn about this from Rabbi Yoshua? I have a different source, this story that follows, which seems to indicate that he learned about it from someone else. Let's follow that. But isn't it taught, when Rabbi Eliezer fell ill, Rabbi Akiva and his colleagues came to visit him. He was sitting on his canopied bed, and they were sitting in his parlor. And that day was Shabbat Eve, and his son Hyrcanus entered to remove his phylacteries, his tefillin. Halachically, we don't wear tefillin on Shabbat. I want us also to note the setting here is important. Physically, the setting is important. They have come to see him after so long, but they're still sitting in another room, and he is in his canopied bed. There's a sort of separation between them. We're going to see the distance start to get smaller and smaller here, a sort of very gradual reconciliation. But in this moment, what matters is that even in this moment of extreme sickness, they're still obeying the excommunication. They're still distancing themselves from him. The other thing I want us to note is that it's Erev Shabbat. It's Friday afternoon. That, of course, is going to be important for the scene with taking off the tefillin that we're going to get to in a moment. But I think it's also symbolic of time is ticking, right? Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus' life is coming to an end. The sun is setting. And just like a rushed Friday afternoon, we know that there is only so much time left to do all the many, many, many things we need to do before we run out of time. Here, the many things being to somehow make peace after this absolute mess of decades. His son, Hyrcanus, comes in to take off his tefillin. He berated him, meaning Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus yells at him, and he left reprimanded. He said to his father's colleagues, "It appears to me that father went insane," meaning it seems like my father is losing it. I came in to take off his tefillin. That's what you're supposed to do on Friday afternoon. He just yelled at me. I don't know what's going on. Maybe he's sort of losing his faculties. Rabbi Eliezer said to them, "He, Hyrcanus, and his mother went insane. How can they neglect Shabbat preparations with regards to prohibitions punishable by stoning and engage in preparations concerning prohibitions by rabbinic decree, such as wearing phylacteries on Shabbat?" Okay, what's going on here? Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus hears, presumably, his son from the other room saying, "I think my father's losing," and he's saying, "I'm losing it. You're losing it. You're bothering yourself with taking off my tefillin, which is a much lower sort of prohibition on Shabbat, when there are much more weighty things, weighty rabbinic, weighty halachically things to be done before Shabbat starts." Let's just note here, there is something that is so clear here about what sort of life has Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus been living since he's been excommunicated. His mind operates fundamentally within the world of the Beit Midrash. There's a disconnect between him and the people around him who are closest to him. They are operating in a very normal way. "I'm going to go and help my father get ready for Shabbat." His brain is operating always on a, well, which prohibition is stricter? How do we determine what should be done first? We determine it according to what is the weight of the law. And that here, of course, is coming out in a sort of humorous way. "I'm crazy, you're crazy." But I think it's actually pointing to the profound loneliness of someone whose brain is always going to be a Beit Midrash brain, who has been living for years, maybe decades, among people who are living in a very different sort of way. They fundamentally don't understand each other. Even he and his son, who's coming in to care for him, there's something about each other that they cannot understand because they're part of different worlds. When the sages saw that his mind was present, they entered and sat before him at a distance of 4 cubits. It's the closest you can come to someone who's been excommunicated. He said to them, "Why have you come?" They said to him, "We have come to study Torah." Let's look at everything here that's being said and not said. Why have you come? He's really saying, okay, what's different now? He's almost trying to force the conversation. And they're not ready for the conversation. They're saying, we've come to study Torah, which in some ways is beautiful, because after all, what has Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus been waiting for all these years, if not someone to come to learn his Torah? But also is a refusal to have the conversation of, maybe we came to make peace, or we came because we know you're dying. Rabbi Eliezer said to them, "And why have you not come until now?" They said to him, "We do not have spare time." Right? It's a total refusal to have the conversation that the story, the setting, the circumstances are really demanding that they have. Rabbi Eliezer said to them, "I would be surprised if these sages die their own death," meaning Rabbi Eliezer is looking at them and saying, none of you are going to die natural deaths. You're all going to die in these terrible ways. And it's, the line here is very hazy. We don't know if this is simply a prophecy or a curse. Rabbi Akiva said to him, "What will be my death?" Rabbi Eliezer said to him, "Your death will be worse than theirs." That is in fact true. Rabbi Akiva dies as one of the 10 martyrs. We'll, if there's ever a part two of this class, we might get to that. Rabbi Eliezer raised his two arms and placed them on his heart, and he said, "Woe to you, my two arms, as they are like two Torah scrolls that are now being rolled up. I have learned much Torah, and I have taught much Torah. I have learned much Torah, and I have not taken away from my teachers, even like a dog lapping from the sea." Let's pay attention here. I think it's a real reveal of who Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus is. First of all, he's looking at his dying body, and he sees in his dying body two Torah scrolls, right? His arms are two Torah scrolls. That's what he identifies with. That's the most important thing to him. And he's saying, I've learned a lot of Torah, and I've taught a lot of Torah, but I know in my learning a lot of Torah that I've only gotten a drop from my teachers of what they have to offer. And of course, this is Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus's dominant fear. This is always the fear of the plastered cistern. I'll absorb as much as I can, but there's still always so much more water out there than I can possibly contain. I have taught much Torah, and my students have taken away from me only like a brush from a tube of paint. Meaning there's so much that's going to die with me. So much that I have not been able to pass down. Moreover, I can teach 300 halachot with regard to a snow-white leprous mark, but no person has ever asked me anything about them. Moreover, I can teach 300 halachot, and some say that he said 3,000 halachot with regard to the planting of cucumbers by sorcery, but no person has ever asked me anything about them, besides Akiva ben Yosef. Let's pay attention to this for one moment. I think there's something here, of course, that's particular to Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus, but also that is so human. One of the tragedies of human death is everything that dies with the person that remains unsaid. What are all the things that live inside of me that I have to say and I have to teach and I have thought about, that I've never had the opportunity to say, and moreover, that no one has ever thought to ask me? There's a real I think, profound human loneliness there. What are the things I care about that no one has ever asked me about? And that's part of why what he goes on to say about Rabbi Akiva here is so important. Rabbi Akiva is the person who thinks to ask. Rabbi Akiva, I think here we're about to see, is more to him like a son than his own son is. Rabbi Akiva, he thinks, understands him. Once he and I were walking along the way, and he said to me, "My teacher, teach me about the planting of cucumbers," meaning this sort of branch of sorcery that we started with. I said one statement, and the entire field became filled with cucumbers. He said, "My teacher, you have taught me about planting them. Teach me about uprooting them." I said one statement, and they were all gathered to one place. The other sages at this point, I think, finally understand. They finally understand what Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus needs from them. And that is to be asked, to be given one last opportunity to teach. The sages asked him, "What is the halakha with regard to ritual impurity?" Note, by the way, what's important about the sort of questions that they're asking? They're asking the sort of genre of question that led to the split in the first place, the questions of ritual purity and impurity that were the subject of the debate about the oven of Achnai. It's a sort of think of healing or attempt to heal that moment. "We will take your opinion on these matters seriously. Once again, please, in your last moments, teach us. What is the halakha with regard to ritual impurity of a ball made of leather and stuffed with rags, and likewise a shoemaking frame, the frame on which a shoe is fashioned, which is made of leather and stuffed with rags, and likewise an amulet wrapped in leather, and a pouch for pearls wrapped in leather, and a small weight which is wrapped in leather?" Rabbi Eliezer said to them, "They are susceptible to impurity, and their purification is affected by immersing them in a ritual bath as they are. What is the halakha with regard to a shoe on a last?" Rabbi Eliezer said to them, "It is pure, and his soul left him in purity." Meaning they ask him one final question, and he says, "It is pure," and at that moment he dies. And symbolically, I think that's very important for the story, right? His last word is pure. Rabbi Yeshua takes that as a sign. And it says Rabbi Yoshua stood on his feet and said, "The vow is permitted, the vow is permitted," meaning the excommunication is over. That matters, by the way, because halachically excommunication lasts even after death. It affects the way that someone can be buried. And Rabbi Yoshua here, I think, is making this decision at the very last moment of Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus' life. Maybe after the very last moment of Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus' life. He couldn't be part of the community in life, but he can be part of it again in death. At the conclusion of Shabbat, Rabbi Akiva encountered the funeral procession from Caesarea to Lod. He was striking his flesh until his blood flowed to the earth. Let's just note here, Rabbi Akiva is in incredible pain. Rabbi Akiva, I think here we're meant to understand, loved Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus in his own way. And that matters. Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus was an incredibly difficult person, and he was also an incredibly earnest person. He was a person who loved Torah with all of his heart and with all of his soul and was not willing to compromise. He began to eulogize him in the row of those comforting the mourners and said, my father, the chariot of Israel and its horsemen." That's the line, by the way, that Elisha says after Elijah, after Eliyahu ascends to heaven in a fiery chariot. Eliyahu, Elijah being another, you might say, both incredibly truthful, incredibly earnest, and incredibly difficult, but beloved figure. "I have many coins, but I do not have a money changer to whom to give them." We now jump out of the story and back into the framing, right? The framing was Rabbi Akiva learned the laws of sorcery from Rabbi Yoshua. And now we're coming back to that discussion and saying, consequently, Rabbi Akiva learned the laws of gathering cucumbers and sorcery from Rabbi Eliezer, right? Rabbi Eliezer told this story about how he taught Rabbi Akiva. He learned it from Rabbi Eliezer, but he did not understand it. Later, he learned it from Rabbi Yoshua, and he explained it to him. Let's pay attention here. This might feel just like an addendum, but I think it matters so much. Part of what is so difficult about the plastered cistern is that the plastered cistern can collect, but can the plastered cistern give in turn? Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus relates this story that mattered so much to him. It was a story where Rabbi Akiva asked him about all these halachot that he desperately wants to pass on. And we see that that mattered. We see that it mattered, I think, both to Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus and to Rabbi Akiva. I don't want us to walk away saying, well, that moment was nothing. But what does the story tell us at the end? It tells us, yes, Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus taught it to him, but Rabbi Akiva couldn't understand it from him. There is something about Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus, the way he teaches, the way he studies, the way he relates to Torah, that Rabbi Akiva couldn't learn from. Later, he learned it from Rabbi Yoshua, and Rabbi Yoshua explained it to him. Why does this matter? I think it matters for a number of reasons. First of all, and I don't want us to overlook this, it matters because these are people's lives. These are people's lives, and they're trying their best to do right by Torah, to do right by this burgeoning community. And in the process, I think trying and often failing to do right by each other, right? So much of this is when you're trying so hard to keep something alive that you're desperately afraid will vanish. What do you end up doing to each other? What do you end up doing to community? Is there a way to heal that after things have gone so wrong? Let's not forget the words of Ima Shalom. I have this tradition from my father's house that there's one thing that God always listens to, and that's the tears of those who have been mistreated. That strand is consciously introduced into this story. What are we doing to each other in the name of this community? But the other is, what sort of Torah are we trying to learn and to teach? Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus is so concerned about nothing getting lost. He is a collector. He is standing up for truth. He is standing up for what does he believe the correct interpretation is. But something in that, something in him, means that even when he is able to teach, he is not understood. There's some sort of a gap there. And so I think at the end of this story, we're left again with the question, how do we come to a sort of understanding of Torah that allows it not only to be taught, but to be learned? And how do we create a sort of community around that that doesn't demand excommunication, that doesn't demand sacrifice of lives? We're going to come back to that next week for a final class that will feature, what's a better word for showdown? A debate between Rabbi Gamliel and Rabbi Yoshua, two of our main characters in this story, and the end of this first generation at Yavneh.